Vermont conversation. Can poverty be eradicated? This question has been at the heart of the work of today's guest, Christopher Curtis. Chris Curtis is a staff attorney for Vermont Legal Aid, and he is co-chair of the Governor's Council on Pathways from Poverty. In the final report of the Governor's Council, Curtis has written, quote, "Today we struggle to move the needle of poverty rates hovering between 10 and 12% of our general population, while close to 13 to 16% of children live in poverty over the last few years. Despite countless task force and work group recommendations and other best efforts, the number of Vermonters living in poverty persists, and progress has been limited or intermittent at best. Even when we receive good news, like a modest reduction in poverty rates in the last year, nearly half of all single mothers and 15,000 children are still without enough to meet their basic needs." On that note, Chris Curtis, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start on a personal note, too. You come from a storied family of people who have been engaging in social issues. Your father, David Curtis, is somebody who has a long reputation working on issues in Vermont. Say a little bit about how you came to come to focus your life's work on tackling poverty.
Certainly. Well, first I should say that I think, like many people, my parents are really my heroes. And that's in part because I grew up in a household where my father in particular is a former defender general, a former legal aid attorney, somebody who also worked at the Vermont Attorney General's office, was deeply engaged and personally committed to addressing inequality. And he was a real civil rights leader and committed to social and economic justice. And that has influenced my whole life. And my mother herself was a psychiatrist in practicing in Shelburne for many years, and she was a strong feminist leader in her own right, and really took care of us as a family after my parents had separated, and just showed me what it is to be a strong woman and a leader in her profession and in her community. So I owe a great debt to both of them. Although I will say that the first thing I ever did in life was get a second chance. And I was a Lund baby, and some of your listeners may be familiar with Lund. It used to be called the Lund Home, or the Home for Friendless Women, actually, when it was originally instituted. And that was a place where women could go and have their babies, and those babies are put up for adoption. Actually, this year, I just saw news that this was the largest year for adoptions ever in Vermont. So there are a lot of kids out there, lucky kids like me, who have been provided loving homes, and a lot of committed parents out there who are trying to do the right thing for their kids.
When did you learn that you were adopted?
I always knew. My parents were always very upfront about that. And it was never a secret in our household. In fact, me and my sister were both adopted, and my brother was their first child that they had together.
How does that shape your thinking about the world today?
Well, like I said, when you start out in life with a second chance, I think it makes you especially sensitive to others who are not as fortunate. And we all need a second chance. We've all had those moments in our lives. And so I think having a special sensitivity to that and an awareness of that is profound. And it gets you outside of yourself and gets you thinking. And I was lucky to have that experience and having parents that fostered that inquisitiveness and curiosity and commitment to those same principles I just talked about.
Do you know anything about your biological parents?
I have some basic non-identifying information, but I've always been conscientious that this is a very difficult choice for any parent to make. And in 1970, at that time, it was a different environment, and we viewed adoption differently than we do today. Today, it's a much more open process. In many cases, there are open adoption situations where the birth parents and adoptive parents know each other, and the child continues to be a part of both lives. But it's really up to the parties at the time, and so I want to respect confidentiality, and my parents are my parents, so I'm a very, very lucky person.
going back to your dad, David Curtis, his bio is a bundle of contradictions. He was a Goldwater Republican, but a lawyer who pushed for social change. He sought to overturn Vermont's restrictive abortion laws in the 1970 case, State versus Bartlett, which later was referenced in the case that did overturn Vermont's abortion laws 2 years later. He was a Republican representing Charlotte in the State House for one term starting in 1975, but then ran unsuccessfully for Attorney General and switched parties. How does a Goldwater Republican end up running as a Democrat and pursuing social issues just 10 years later?
Well, aren't we all just a bundle of contradictions? I mean, I think that's human nature, and I think my dad always had a strong sense of mission and a strong sense of who he was as a person. Although there's a funny story, when he was at a law firm picnic very early in his legal career, he and a friend snuck up the at the time the newly elected Governor Hoff was visiting, and made an appearance, and my dad and another compatriot snuck up behind the governor's Cadillac or limousine or whatever he was driving at the time and stuck a big Goldwater bumper sticker on the back of Phil Hoff's car. So he had a keen sense of humor as well. But later in life, of course, he and Phil Hoff became great friends, and Phil was in many ways a mentor to my dad. And they have a law firm in Burlington still called Hoff Curtis, although Governor Hoff, of course, is retired, and my dad is deceased, but the firm continues. And, you know, I think he just evolved personally and professionally over the years. And, you know, he wanted to be true to himself. And that was also, you know, he went through a process of coming out as a gay man in the late 70s and 80s after my parents were divorced. And so he was dealing with profound changes personally and professionally, but he wanted to always be true to who he was as a person. Again, that sort of sense of mission-driven purpose.
Your parents divorced in 1978 when you were eight, and as you mentioned, your father and your mother both later came out as gay. How did that affect you then and now? And, you know, this is the 1970s we're talking about. People were not coming out as freely as they are today.
It was a different time, and it really, again, had a profound impact on me, because to watch your parents go through a very difficult and painful personal transition in terms of separating from each other, and thinking about putting the best interests of their kids first always, that was their priority. Very difficult time, though, no question about it. And certainly, you know, society's judgments and mores were different then than they are today. There's a lot more acceptance, and of course we even now have marriage equality, which was not something that was available to them during my dad's lifetime, and subsequently my mom luckily has been able to marry her partner of 25 plus years. So it just, I think, speaks volume about their character that they were able to just be themselves. They never hid anything, and Vermont, of course, is a very accepting community. So I think people just took them. People in Vermont take you at face value, and if you're honest about who you are and what you're doing, people value that. So they didn't really have it was not an impediment, I don't think, professionally, for either of them. But as a kid growing up and watching that, takes a lot of courage, and just two very brave people.
We're talking with Christopher Curtis. He is a staff attorney with Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Governor's Council on Pathways from Poverty. If you want to join this conversation, you can call 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Today, we're seeing a resurgence of far-right groups, including the Klan, Nazis, and who have now rebranded themselves as the alt-right. You have personal experience of this movement. In 1980, you moved with your dad, at least in the summers, to rural Tennessee and then South Dakota to advocate for the poor. And you watched from an upstairs window in Tennessee while your dad stood quietly on the street protesting a passing Ku Klux Klan march. What does it make you think now to see this far-right groups now part of mainstream politics? In fact, one of its leaders, Steve Bannon, having a seat in the White House.
Well, first of all, I refuse to accept this mainstream. I think the vast majority of Americans reject racism of that sort and reject those views. And we know that a majority of Americans, in fact, rejected the president-elect. And particularly in Vermont, we saw large numbers of people kind of rejecting that philosophy, that kind of hateful speech, hateful rhetoric, and any kind of embrace for that sort of philosophy or ideology. So I don't accept that that's mainstream. I think there is a small fringe community out there who may be taking a license in the fact that some of this language that we're seeing fallout from the presidential campaign has opened a door. And I reject that. I think Vermonters reject it. And I think as a community, a society, a nation, we need to reject that strongly. I do remember that time. In fact, the birthplace of the Klan was about 40 miles south of Columbia, Tennessee, where my dad was running legal services of South Central Tennessee at that time. And I will never forget my sister and I being told, go upstairs to the second or third floor window and stay put and don't come out. And it wasn't just my dad. I think the whole firm actually went downstairs out to the street because they knew that there was going to be this march coming through, which was fairly common at the time. And I think they were sending a message that they were not going to accept that. They were going to oppose that. And there wasn't there wasn't a riot or an altercation or anything like that, but they wanted to be out there watching and letting those marchers know, they got their license and they had their free speech permission to go and do their march, but that was not going to be accepted by the entire community.
What insight can you offer in the work that you do, working with people who often don't have a voice in mainstream political discourse? What insight does it give you to what just happened in the election with Trump winning, as you point out, not the popular vote, but the electoral vote? But clearly a loud and angry protest vote from many people.
I think there are a lot of people out there who feel hopeless or feel powerless. And that's very real. And I don't think we can discount or deny that. But it's not just true of working white Americans. I think that's long been true for the African-American community in this country and for low-income and working people in this country. And that's why I think that Bernie Sanders had tapped into something that was not just about income inequality, not just about sort of where you fall on the socioeconomic ladder, but something very real about people's engagement with government, people's engagement in their communities, people feeling left out, people feeling like they didn't have a voice. And so I think that's the place to start, is meeting people where they're at and making sure that people have a voice in what's going on in their communities, in their state, in their country. And my hope is that if local and state and national leaders can begin to do that, we will see a change and we will be the country that we want to be. And we'll be able to promote not only progressive values, but we'll be able to build on the progress that we've made on civil rights in this country, economic progress in this country. But we're lacking. And, you know, one of the things we can talk about a little later in the program is the Poverty Council report that you referred to. And just fundamentally, are we missing something? Because baked into the economic cake is a presumption that we're going to have a certain number of people living in poverty. So how do we deal with that? And what does it mean? Where does it come from? One of the things that we tried to do as a council was to meet our charge by not just making recommendations every year, but this year really saying, where does poverty come from? Where does it come from? It's a profound question. But if you look back at the history of Vermont, at the history of this country, one thing we do know is that 240 years ago, the founders of our country, the framers of our Constitution, did not anticipate, did not contemplate equal economic opportunity for all. We take that for granted today as a fundamental philosophical principle. Everybody should be treated equally. Everybody should have an opportunity. And yet we have systems and institutions that have been bequeathed to us, passed down over a couple of hundred years, that never contemplated that African Americans in this country would be equal, that never contemplated women as equals in our political or economic spheres. And in relative terms, those are recent developments. So why are we surprised that women in Vermont only make 84 cents on the dollar as compared to men for the same job? When in the 1960s and 70s, it was really unusual for a woman to be part of a white-collar profession even, or even to not, you know, even to be in the workforce generally. These are recent developments, and I think that we need to sort of more fundamentally look at, if we're just adding a few dollars here or there, or taking away a few dollars here or there, depending on a given economic climate, depending on a given budget year, is that really progress? Or do we need to more fundamentally look at our systems and institutions and figure out how to adequately engage everyone and make sure that there is, in fact, true economic opportunity for all?
Talk a little bit about the Governor's Poverty Council. You are having your last meeting tomorrow, I believe. What was the charge of the council?
Well, the council is a great story because 3 years ago, Governor Shumlin and advocates got together and said, the way the budget setting process is, doesn't really seem to be working. There's a lack of communication in terms of what the priorities are for low-income advocates, what we know works, what's effective in terms of alleviating the symptoms of poverty. And we know that the governor goes through a process that's much more formal in terms of setting its budgetary priorities and then introducing that in the legislature. And we just felt like if there was a way to inform the executive before that process took place, or while that process was unfolding, how much better would that be? Because then the governor has the advice and counsel of folks and would have a better understanding of what the primary concerns might be, where the challenges might be, and might be able to actively do some things to help. And more information is always better. So the governor, to his credit, said, hey, I want to assemble a council of 30 members. No government officials. These are all advocates from their communities, and there are five seats preserved for low-income Vermonters themselves to serve, to share their experience, and to give us the benefit of what they think are the pressing needs. And so we embarked on a mission of really first getting ourselves assembled and dividing up into subcommittees, affordable housing, economic empowerment, education, and so on. And then thinking through, trying to assess sort of what's already out there, what's working, what do we think isn't working as well, and then trying to provide the governor with a menu of options. If you look at the reports and recommendations, they're voluminous. They go on for pages and pages, and there's no expectation, really, that all of these things could be picked up and adopted all at once. But I think our goal was to say, we defer to the governor. Here are some suggestions, and which ones fit with your priorities and your mission, and then can we work with our partners in the legislature to see if some of these things might actually pass?
What were some of the key recommendations of the Poverty Council?
You know, the council, for being an all-citizen group of volunteers, has had remarkable success. And some of those successes are everything from addressing what's called the benefits cliff, right? So there's sometimes in the state bureaucracy, there's an inattention to or inability to deal with the fact that somebody who's receiving some temporary assistance, either through what most people refer to as welfare or some other temporary cash assistance programs, if they go out and get a job and start working, they might earn a dollar but lose two in cash benefits. So that's actually a strange disincentive to a poor person who's just trying to make it to be able to succeed and move off, graduate from that program. So one thing that the legislature did and the administration did that was a recommendation, and by the way, the benefit cliff issue recommendations to address that go all the way back to the Douglas administration, probably before. So it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. I think there's a wide acknowledgement that there ought to be done to better help people transition off of public assistance. But one of the things they did was say, you're going to be allowed to earn and keep a little more from that job that you get before you start losing a dollar in assistance. So it's a temporary stopgap, but it allows folks to transition a little bit more easily. And the other thing that they did was they said at the same time, we know that child care is critical, especially for families, primarily single moms, who are returning to the workforce and may have kids. So we're going to extend the Reach Ahead program, which is a food and nutrition program for families that are exiting. But your attachment to that program gives you eligibility for 100% child care subsidy. So by extending that out at a smaller rate to a second year, it provides that eligibility for child care subsidy for 24 months. And that's going to do a lot to help single moms be able to continue on in the workforce, maybe have a chance to get through that first year, get a raise, et cetera, and ultimately be able to move to financial and economic self-sufficiency. That's just a small example. Some other ones that maybe your listeners are more familiar with. Recently, there's been a big push towards driver restoration. This was the brainchild of T.J. Donovan, who's the incoming attorney general. But when he was state's attorney, he and I got together and we said, what can we do about this problem? This is a poverty trap. A middle-income person or a high-income person can pay their speeding ticket, move on with their lives, but a poor person who can't come up with that couple hundred dollars, because that's the difference between making rent or not, can't pay the ticket. So then their license gets suspended. And then they get picked up again for driving with a license suspended. So they get another ticket on top of that. And the choice for low-income people in a rural state like Vermont is an impossible one. Do you keep driving illegally and racking up tickets? That's what people have done. 50,000 Vermonters are caught up in this broken system. And the legislature and the governor, again, to their credit, said, we got to do something about this. So recently there was a driver restoration law that was passed, and now traffic court judges can take income into consideration when setting fines. There's a repayment plan option that allows people to do it in installments. And then there was a sort of blanket, if you came in with a three-month period for older tickets, you could get all caught up at $30 a ticket. I'll tell you, I was out there when the pilot programs ran outside the Costello Courthouse up in Burlington, and State's Attorney Donovan was there supervising and managing the project that day. And there were over 1,000 people, 1,500 people showed up, you know, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, waiting in a huge line around the block, mile-long line. And it just showed how much of a need there is out there.
Well, we're talking with Chris Curtis. He's a staff attorney with Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Governor's Council on Pathways from Poverty. We're going to come back after the news and be joined by another member of the Governor's Council. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after the news.
.org.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're talking this week about how to eradicate poverty. That's the question that has been the focus of the work of Chris Curtis, our guest in the first half hour. He's a staff attorney at Vermont Legal Aid, and he co-chairs the Governor's Council on Pathways from Poverty. We're also joined now by Whitney Nichols, who a consumer advocate and another member of the Governor's Council on Poverty. Whitney, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks very much for having me.
Why don't we start by, if you would just share a little of your story and how you came to be involved in the Governor's Poverty Council.
Sure. Well, let's see, about 12 or 15 years ago, I was living in an apartment without hot water or heat, and I was waiting for a favorable determination of my Social Security disability. And it didn't come through until after Christmas, and I was in the process of being evicted. At any rate, a person who has been a professional in the past, I'm a special education consultant, and so I've had an education, I have a hidden disability, and I've gone through many different experiences with neglect and so forth. I'll spare you the details. At any rate, I became acquainted with the council through Linda Ryan, one of the co-chairs of the Vermont Coalition. She's one of the council's co-chairs along with Christopher. By the way, hi, Chris.
Hi, Whitney.
Hi. At any rate, so Linda and I knew each other from the Vermont Coalition to End Homelessness. So through that association, then she invited me to join the Poverty Council. I feel that we've really had an opportunity to have really get some positive work done. We still have a long way to go.
So, Whitney, in that story, you were it sounds like you're alluding to the fact that you became homeless as a result of the situation that you just described. What does it mean to be homeless in Vermont? What was that for you?
It's a form of trauma for me. It was a terrible experience. I was living out of my car at this time of the year, in fact. So this time of the year is a particularly difficult time just before the holidays for me in the darkness. And having gone through that experience with the eviction and then no heat or hot water, that was after, I finally received services that I needed through the Brower Area Drop-In Center. And Melinda Busno was the director who was took me under her wing, and she personally escorted me to the formal eviction proceedings. At any rate, that was my first association with the Drop-In Center. And I remember feeling like a criminal after those court proceedings. But the experience of, I remember driving by the Drop-In Center, not even being able to look at it. And there was that much sort of stigma for me and about that, about the condition.
What is a drop-in center, and what is the one that you went to?
Brower Area Drop-In Center was a day facility for people who needed to come in and do laundry or shower. That's a place for them to have their mail sent and so forth. There was a formerly separate organization called Morningside Shelter. And Morningside Shelter is a facility for overnight, primarily for families. I was denied services through Morningside Shelter because I was still abusing alcohol. And as I said, I didn't get the services that I needed until I got to the drop-in center. And those services needed to work things like advocacy and case management. And I was able to secure housing. Finally, Shelter Plus Care is a program, a federal program, which provides housing with supports. And once I had the stabilized housing, I was able to finally begin to go through some of these separate issues of trauma and so forth.
How long did you live out of your car?
It's a difficult question to ask because I think I've been homeless on and off all of my life, and including when I was living at home with my family. So, but during this period of time, that period of time I was living out of my car was probably for about it was under a year.
So through an entire winter, at least.
Until I finally received my Social Security disability determination.
And do you? I mean, to stay warm in your car in the winter, do you just leave it running all night?
When it became very cold, I would do that. I had piles and piles of blankets and pillows in the front seat. I also had a Scottish Terrier, Brody, who kept me. We kept each other warm, basically.
And were you aware of many other homeless people who were perhaps living out of their car or in some sort of makeshift shelter?
I was not as aware of other people, I think, because I was in crisis myself.
So you mentioned that there was a shelter, Morningside, but it was a dry shelter, so you were not eligible. So were there any other shelters for homeless people where you lived?
No. However, there's some good news is that Brattleboro now has a new program where the Drop-In Center and Morningside Shelter have collaborated. It's called Groundworks Collaborative. And I'm actually serving on the board of Groundworks now as a consumer representative. But so things have really changed radically from those days of being denied services where there's an increasing awareness that you provide housing first and then you can begin to deal with some of the other issues like addictions or mental health challenges.
Well, your story is remarkable because you've gone from a picture of being completely disempowered to one where you are now trying to empower others by working on this statewide council. Given your experience, what for you is your highest priority in the advocacy work that you do?
The most important thing I want to get across is the fact that you can survive loss of housing, and that there is hope. but there's still areas that we need to push forward to change. And that one of the most important things is that anyone of us can become homeless at any time.
What gave you hope in some of those long, cold nights that you had to endure in your car?
It's a great question. I feel for me that metaphorically this was like being in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, and I didn't know what I was being called to do. All that I knew was that I was resilient, and I was pretty stubborn, I must say, and persistent. And so I think that was how I managed to get through, and I think that message I want to get across to people, that there is hope. I think for me, my faith was something really helped me to get through the worst time, and I feel just being able to talk today before the Christmas holidays, that this is another example of an opportunity, and it's part of my recovery.
In the advocacy work you were doing with the Governor's Council, when you see people in your position or in the position that you were in, what do you feel is the most important thing you can do to help them?
It's a great question also. One of the things I discovered was how prejudiced I was against people who were panhandling. And I was really uncomfortable, frankly. And one of the initiatives that we have at Groundworks Collaborative now is to have what's called a spare change program, where it's a way of increasing people's awareness of the humiliation it feels like many people feel when they are begging or asking for a handout. And the thing is that I think that panhandling, I don't like that term, but begging or asking for a handout is not a crime. What it is a crime is when people are intimidating or they're disrupting, and that becomes an illegal issue or a police issue.
Talk a little bit about the Poverty Council. What are you proud of that you've accomplished by being part of the Governor's Council?
Increasing that awareness. I think that there are people who are educated and appear to be normal, and that we're just like everyone else.
And let me turn it back to Chris Curtis from Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Poverty Council. Talk a little bit about homelessness and affordable housing and the crisis around that in Vermont and what can be done about it.
Well, I think Whitney's story is so profound and it's moving. And sadly, it's not uncommon for families that are being economically displaced or dislocated. And, you know, one of the things that we know is that in Vermont, it costs about $1,000 a month, a little more than $1,000 a month, just to rent a modest two-bedroom apartment. That's a huge expense. That's a huge monthly expense. So you've got to make over $20 an hour, or your household has to combine to make over $20 an hour full-time for a month to be able to make that roughly a third of your expenses for the month, which is what a housing allowance really should be. It shouldn't be more than that. And that's a huge burden that a lot of Vermonters just simply can't meet. We also know that there are only about 30% of Vermonters who would be eligible to receive some form of rental subsidy can get it, just because there is way more demand than there is supply. So one of the things we're very concerned about moving forward is that if there are deep cuts at the federal level, we're going to see Section 8 federal subsidies dry up and disappear. You're going to see longer waiting lists to be able to get those vouchers. And you're going to see people who really just fall off the housing map and are going to be subjected to some of the really terrible conditions that Whitney described.
Richard, may I add to that, please?
Yes.
And this is in regards to an issue that I had. I was formerly in a program called Medicaid for working people with disabilities. And I was eligible for that program because of my challenges. However, when I reached retirement age, my income from retirement was changed so that I was no longer qualified for Medicaid. So there's a real strong disincentive for people who reach retirement age to not continue to work. And I think that work and employment is so important for people in order to feel normal, basically.
That's a great point. You know, one of the things that the Poverty Council, really the primary recommendation that the Poverty Council is making for this year, is to suggest that there really should be an occupancy fee, a very modest, you know, less than the price of a cup of coffee these days, $2 a night for out-of-state overnight visitors. And that means that this is really a narrowly tailored fee that would not fall on Vermonters. I think the Department of Travel and Tourism says 94% of those overnight stays are from away, from out of state. And these are folks that come for our beautiful ski areas or to, you know, engage in recreation in our beautiful state over the summer or winter months, and really who can afford it. But right now we have a system that says if you're homeless in Vermont, if you go to apply for aid from the state will shelter you at a motel. And that's a significant cost to Vermont taxpayers. It's also a burden and a public service that a small number of motels are providing to our homeless population, although it is not a good long-term affordable housing solution. It's very temporary. You can either get 28 nights or 84 nights if you have a truly catastrophic situation. So it's very much a Band-Aid approach. It's not going to solve anybody's long-term housing crisis. And the notion would be if you did this $2 occupancy fee on out-of-state overnight guests, you could generate $12 million a year in dedicated revenue to solve our affordable housing and homelessness crisis. And that's really essential because for years we've heard about the housing crisis in Vermont, but there's no new money. There's no revenue that's actually dedicated to solving the problem. And this is a way to do it that's narrowly tailored to very important governmental purpose and actually would give the taxpayers a return on their investment, because ultimately the goal would be to move away from a very temporary motel program so the taxpayers wouldn't have to spend on that anymore.
What about raising the minimum wage? That's been on the table nationally and locally. Bernie Sanders has certainly brought a lot of attention to the fight for 15. What would it do?
The council's firmly behind the fight for 15, a $15 minimum wage to help folks meet their basic needs. And, you know, it only makes sense that if you are working hard and playing by the rules, you ought to be able to afford and meet your basic necessities. So that's housing, food, utilities, you know, making sure that you can put gas in the car so you can get your kids to school or meet your other community obligations. And we know that more and more Vermonters are just having a hard time making ends meet.
What do you think, Chris Curtis, has been Governor Shumlin's legacy on this issue of tackling poverty?
I think it's mixed. And one thing I do appreciate about Governor Shumlin's tenure is that I think he's taken the time to listen and learn. Very early on in his administration, there was a misguided proposal to really take money out of working people's pockets by reducing the earned income tax credit, which is one of the greatest anti-poverty tools that we have. At tax time, it's a refundable cash tax credit for low-income working Vermonters, and often that money is used to catch up on back rent, catch up on utilities, and be able to kind of keep going. And it's a benefit that only goes to working Vermonters, so you got to work to get it. Vermont is among the best in the country, and we should be proud of the fact that we've worked over the years to improve upon the earned income tax credit and make it something that really provides a return for working people. But there was a proposal to sort of chop a big chunk of that earned income tax credit, plow it into child care subsidies and so on. And also over the years, there have been proposals to reduce the Reach Up program, which is temporary cash assistance for primarily single moms with kids. And that's making those trade-offs and taking away from one to give to another, that's not going to help lift people out of poverty fundamentally. That's destabilizing in one area, stabilizing in another. So I think through the establishment of the Poverty Council, the governor has done a lot to learn and take the time to listen and be more responsive. And so I give him great credit for that. It would have been easy to sort of shut us out and say, you know, this is the path we're going to go on, and we're going to continue to make these sort of trade-offs year in and year out. And so I respect the fact that he has come around on a lot of these issues. And he's done more to, you know, just last year pushed very hard to ban the box on employment applications so that folks who have been formerly incarcerated or who have a criminal conviction in their past don't have to declare that at the time that they're applying on a paper application for a job, which just gets their foot in the door. The employers can always ask the question, but it allows somebody to say, hey, I made a mistake 5 years ago. I've learned from it. I've moved on. I paid my debt to society. I need a job, and I can do it. And there are a lot of Vermonters who can do a lot of things. And so we don't want to foreclose opportunity for folks just because they made a mistake sometime in their past. So, you know, the governor's coming around a lot of this stuff, the driver restoration project we already mentioned. He's also done things like enhancing a state rental subsidy program. He doubled something called the Vermont Rental Subsidy Program, which provides 12 months of rental subsidies from the state. And that opened a lot of doors for people to get on the federal subsidy waiting list, but who didn't have anything to tide them over. And we need to keep people in their housing. We don't want people out on the street. We want to help people stay in their housing. And that's in many cases, housing is where it starts. Because if you don't have housing, very hard to keep a job, very hard to meet your other commitments to your family or your community. You have to have a safe place to be.
We're talking with Chris Curtis, staff attorney with Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Governor's Council on Poverty, and also with Whitney Nichols, a consumer advocate and also a member of the Governor's Council. Chris, what signals are you getting from the incoming Scott administration about what they may be doing on the issues that you will be focused on around affordable housing, homelessness, and other, you know, poverty reduction measures?
Well, the Poverty Council was a three-year charge established by executive order, and so we've asked Governor-elect Scott to consider extending the council for another three-year term, or perhaps even making it a standing council. We know that the Governor-elect has graciously sent one of his staffers who will attend our last Poverty Council meeting, which is set for tomorrow. And we're hopeful that they'll be listening and be open to those suggestions. One thing I do know is that this council is made up of 30 remarkable individuals, just like Whitney, many of whom are either have direct experiences with direct services in Vermont or who are experts in their fields themselves. They're homeless shelter providers, folks from the mental health community, people with disabilities, et cetera. And so I know that all of those voices are not going to go away. And I know that these advocates are tireless, and they'll continue to work to see social and economic justice in the Green Mountains.
Whitney Nichols, what would make the biggest difference in your life in terms of the kind of services or access to assistance? What would be the biggest bang for the buck?
Well, I think, first of all, we really have to end the stigma and discrimination for people who are doing without, or people who are in poverty, people who are homeless, and people with, especially with mental health challenges, I think that were underlooked, often underlooked. And so there are organizations like Vermont Psychic Survivors or VPS that are going to be very useful for helping to help people become more aware of the stigma and discrimination. But that's, I think, where we're really going to have to start, and we're going to have to start and help people to become educated so that they know that it's not something to be feared.
How do you end stigma?
I think educating people and letting them, putting a real name to a real face, that's part of my work.
And what do you do? How do you put that face to the name? And
well, I'm not. You can't see my face right now, but no doubt. But I've become very public about speaking out, and so I'll be talking tomorrow with Christopher at the council meeting. And we have our Homeless Awareness Day coming up in January, and January 5th, I believe it is. And we'll speak out there and just to show people that we're real and we're there.
Whitney, you mentioned something that really struck home for me. My first job out of college living in Boston was working in a homeless shelter. And the thing that struck me the most was how little difference there was between me and the guests in the shelter. And you mentioned how, kind of along those same lines, can you just elaborate about your observations about what separates those with homes from those without?
What separates them? People who are homeless don't have the credibility, I think. And I think that people tend to be blamed for something that's often out of their control.
Mm-hmm. What struck me in my conversations with many of the guests at the homeless shelter I worked in was It was sometimes a very small thing, losing a job, and there just wasn't perhaps the family member to provide, tide them over that month, or, you know, a marriage breaking up. Small things and no safety net equals you go right through to the floor. There is no hand to stop the fall.
Thank you, David, because I wanted to sort of add, that's how, one of the ways that I started to become homeless was I was a respectable landowner. I had an old historical house that I restored in Marlboro. And I, when a long-term relationship ended, I could no longer afford the mortgage payments, so I had to sell the house. And that was excruciatingly difficult to do that. But that's how things sort of started to spiral downward for me.
Chris Curtis, I want to ask, you're dealing with some of the toughest populations. You see people in crisis. What gives you hope as you continue to do this work, and especially at a time of there's a lot of anxiety nationally and locally about the fate of people who are living on the margins? What keeps you going?
I see acts of heroism, large and small, every day, and it's really my clients. You know, I always tell my clients that, you know, I'm not there to save them. They're here to save themselves, and they're heroes in the eyes of their kids, and or in the eyes of a partner or a spouse. And sometimes raising your hand and asking for help is the hardest and bravest thing you can do. And so my job is to really listen. And then to help them tell their story, and then try to achieve a measure of justice for them. So I view my clients as real heroes, and they're trying to make it in an environment where the deck is often stacked against them, and where it's just very difficult to do. I want to share with your listeners a wonderful book that gives some glimmer of insight through personal storytelling of the lives of folks, a book called Evicted, that's out there by Matthew Desmond, and folks should really pick it up and take a read.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Chris Curtis, staff attorney for Vermont Legal Aid and co-chair of the Governor's Council on Poverty, and Whitney Nichols, also a member of the Governor's Council. Thanks to both of you for being on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having us.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. I'm David Goodman. I'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another conversation.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. The special feature from VBSR is underwritten in part by Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By CW Print and Design, formerly Copy World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, and Ski Erg. Proud to support nonprofit groups such as Local Motion, Vermont's statewide nonprofit advocate for walkable and bikeable communities. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy transformation while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. As well as over 750 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org.